Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, February 2nd, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Is the free press under attack? What is the impact? Those are the questions that we hope to think through today. Why? Well, last week, former CNN anchor Don Lemon and independent journalist Georgia Fort were arrested days after covering a protest inside of a church in Minnesota where the pastor happens to be an ICE official. The Justice Department is treating the situation like a federal civil rights conspiracy. They've alleged that the journalists were part of a coordinated attack on a church. The attorney general even went on social media saying, if you violate the sacred right to worship, they are coming after you. But these arrests and charges against Lemon and Fort represent just one recent example of government swipes at the free press. President Donald Trump has sued multiple news organizations. A Washington Post reporter had their home raided. The Trump administration has interfered in media mergers. The president has called for journalists to be fired. And so we're asking again, is the free press under attack? What is the impact? And we've got three guests, a First Amendment lawyer, CNN's media analyst who's been following this story, as well as a longtime journalist who has been on the receiving end of government action. And so today we've got this packed show, but we also want to hear from you. Are you concerned about the freedom of the press? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can leave your comments in the chat.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. First, a trio of local news stories. We start with this update. If you didn't already know, it's very cold. It's still very cold.
Is it?
Yes, it is. Indeed. The world is still covered in ice.
Mm-hmm.
And Philadelphians, if they weren't already upset, are getting kind of antsy.
Big mad, yeah.
Parking spots are at a premium right now. Of course, there's the raging debate over whether you're allowed to save a spot that you already dug out. Our news partner 6ABC reported there was a violent confrontation over one such spot in Kensington. A man was seriously injured in that melee. There's also been video of folks walking on the iced over Schuylkill River. By the way, police say don't do that.
Mm.
And more generally, there has been some frustration here in the city over the conditions on city streets. The Inquirer reported last week that when the snowstorm ended over a week ago, many smaller streets had not been plowed. And how you evaluate the city's performance here is probably a matter of perspective, but some folks certainly feel the city has fallen short under these admittedly difficult circumstances.
Yeah, I know city workers have been grinding for a week plus, but the weather is not cooperating. But like you said, it's hard to judge because if you're driving on the highways and on the main streets, it looks like the city did a great job. But if you live on one of those little back streets, I know my street, it's still covered in ice. If you're walking, it's really hard to walk.
Yeah.
The curb cuts in many places are not cleared. I can only imagine if you need assistance to walk, if you use a cane or a wheelchair, it is virtually impossible to get around the city right now. And that's downtown.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I can't even imagine what the neighborhoods look like. So I know the city's working hard, but the frustration is starting to bubble to the surface.
Yeah. Well, look, I think we're all learning that natural melting is priced into the plan,
yes,
right? And it's not happening right now, which is rare, right? And so I give them, it's hard to contextualize
hard.
All of this because almost always within a week you get some melting. We're getting no melting and there's very little relief on the horizon. I will say though, for Mayor Sherelle Parker, you're often judged on what you run on and what's considered sort of like your core message to voters. And city services was always her big pitch to voters. And the fact that city services, at least for many people, have fallen short, That's going to hurt her more than another politician who might have run on a different platform. I mean, this is really one of her core promises to constituents.
Yeah, and I sometimes think you have to underpromise and overdeliver. You have to tell people, look, this is going to be really hard, y'all. It's cold, you know, and just tell people it's going to be a slog. And if you do better than that, then they're cheering you on.
Right, but clean and green's been her thing forever, right? And so she can't really run away from that.
Yeah, and by the way, it's Groundhog Day, and Punxsutawney Phil saw his shadow, so guess what? There's not going to be a relief if you believe the groundhog.
Guess what? I don't believe him because I don't want to. How about that? Story number two.
All right. Something you can believe. A record number of people showed up on Friday night for the first women's professional basketball games played in the city of Philadelphia since 1998. 21,490 fans packed into the sold-out Xfinity Mobile Arena in South Philly to welcome Unrivaled. It's a Miami-based women's professional basketball league. They set all-time attendance records. And by the way, if you don't
all
know...
All-time, by
all
the way.
All-time attendance records.
There has not been a single event at that arena in South Philadelphia attended by more people than that women's basketball series of games just this weekend.
And it was amazing. I was so blessed to be there. And it was a doubleheader, 2 3-on-3 games back to back. The Breeze versus the Phantom and the Rose versus the Lunar Owls.
Lunar Owls?
Yeah.
What a name.
I know. The game's fast paced.
Hoot, baby.
Game's fast paced. And they had this very special feature on the fourth quarter where they set a target
score. Yeah.
And whoever gets there first.
It's not timed, essentially.
Yeah, it's not timed. And it's really makes it very exciting. The crowd was electric. Philly natives Kalia Copper and Natasha Cloud, they played for the first time at home. Here's a clip of Tasha Cloud at the game. I think we have that clip. Take a look.
Young Tasha be really proud, man. I'm a kid that mid-major, Delco kid, Philly kid. No one expected me to be here. My family's over there in the stands. I'm just really proud.
A lot of tears, Avi. And by the way, comedian Wanda Sykes and her wife Alice Sykes, they're part of the Philly Sisters, the group that worked really hard to get Philly its own WNBA team. And you and I were both very happy that in 2030, we're going to get that. But they also are part owners of Unrivaled. And the game attracted Dawn Staley, who's everybody referred to as the queen of Philly. comedian Leslie Jones was there. Robin Roberts was there. Sixers players were there. Very cool.
Yeah, it was the place to be, wasn't
place
it?
Place to be.
South Philly was the place to be. It was amazing to see the turnout. It's interesting to appraise what's going on with Unrivaled, which, by the way, they play in the offseason when the WNBA is not happening. The TV ratings have been down this year for Unrivaled, way down actually from their first season. But then you're seeing big turnouts in person for events like this when they hit the road. So, you know, it's trying to establish that new equilibrium for a new league. Clearly, there's a lot of interest. Of course, TV then is where the money is made.
Yeah.
So you have to establish that presence as well. I'm very curious to see what happens with Unrivaled going forward. But it's certainly a good sign for Philly's interest in a WNBA team, which is forthcoming.
And I cannot forget Central Jersey girl Marina Mabry, who lit up the court during the second game. She scored 27 points in the first quarter. I had goosebumps. Mm. And I mean, like, she was
calling SOS trying to cover her.
That was a great, great game.
Why am I producer shaking? That was a good, the producers are shaking their head. Like, that was a bad, that was a good pun. Thank you, Al. Okay.
Yes.
Let's give out some more love. How about that? Nice showing for Philly artists at the Grammys Sunday night, by the way. Philly native and Kappa grad Christian McBride won for Best Jazz Performance and Best Jazz Ensemble. The latter was from Without Further Ado, Volume 1. Let's hear a little bit from that. All right. Nice stuff there from Christian McBride. He now has 11 Grammys, by the way.
Wow.
Philly's Andre Harris was among the group of songwriters who penned Folded by Kehlani. That song won Best R&B Performance. And Best Rock Album went to Never Enough by the band Turnstile. Mm-hmm. That record was produced by Central grad Will Yip. And Will Yip, if you don't know, is a rising star in the producer world. He just opened a huge new studio in South Philly, trying to make Philly a place to go for big bands to record albums. And Yip has a really interesting backstory. He's the son of a Chinatown restaurateur, and it seems like he's really on the come up. So, Will Yip, congratulations to him, Christian McBride, Andre Harris, and all the winners.
I love it. And I want to take a moment to shout out Germantown native EVE, aka Eve, who after 27 years got her Grammy for her track. She did a verse in You Got Me by none other than The Roots and Erykah Badu back in 1999. She actually never got her Grammy from that performance. That
Why
was a Grammy.
Why did she get it?
Well, she was an unsigned 19-year-old artist in 1999. So they did not give her credit, even though her verse was prominently on that album.
Wow.
But they gave her her Grammy over the weekend. Because of
justice delayed but not denied.
Not
for
denied
Eve.
For Eve. So there you go. There's another little Philly tidbit there.
Yeah, and I'm very interested about this new studio project from Will Yip in South Philadelphia.
I am too.
Because look, Philly's had ebbs and flows as a place where people come to record music. Of course, we know about the Sound of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Gamble and Huff. That was a huge peak in the 70s. Before that, the American Bandstand era. But, you know, recently certainly people record more in Nashville, LA, New York.
They do.
I love the idea
of
someone.
But Philly's always going to bring good music. And rock
well,
music
good artists,
too.
But
yeah.
I love the idea of someone planting their flag and saying people are going to record great music here.
Yeah.
We're going to be a place where people come to make music and to make their careers. So I wish Will Yip a lot of luck and a lot of respect to him for trying to do that here in Philadelphia. Coming up, we're talking about the freedom of the press. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. At the end of last week, two journalists, including former CNN star Don Lemon, were arrested after covering a protest of a Minnesota church pastor who is also an ICE official. The Trump administration says the journalists were part of a coordinated attack on the church. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche had this to say on ABC.
Nobody in this country should feel comfortable storming into a church while it's ongoing and disrupting that church service and thinking that we're just going to stand by and let that happen, because there is a statute that does not allow that to happen. It doesn't matter if you happen to be a former CNN journalist.
Now, after Don Lemon was released on Friday, he rebuked those charges and said this to a crowd of reporters outside a Los Angeles courthouse.
Last night, the DOJ sent a team of federal agents to arrest me in the middle of the night for something that I've been doing for the last 30 years, and that is covering the news. The First Amendment of the Constitution protects that work for me and for countless of other journalists who do what I do. I stand with all of them, and I will not be silenced.
The arrests are raising concerns about press freedoms, and they come on the heels of a Washington Post reporter's home being raided in January as part of an investigation into one of her suspected sources. So how is all of this impacting the press, and what does it mean for the Constitution?
Kicking off that conversation with us today is Will Creeley, the legal director of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Will, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Brian Stelter is the chief media analyst for CNN and the lead author of the Reliable Sources newsletter. Brian, welcome to Studio 2.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And our question for you today, our listener, are you concerned about the freedom of the press? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so I wanted to sort of start the conversation a little bit with your reaction, Will and Brian, because when you hear journalists arrested for covering a protest, what's the first question that sort of you have to figure out the answer to in order to determine whether this is an actual, you know, prosecution or if it's a violation of the First Amendment? Will?
Yeah, the first thing I want to do is see the charges. Mm-hmm. As a First Amendment attorney, I want to know what the government's theory is. What are they alleging has happened here? Why isn't this just trespassing? Why are there federal charges? Why are we getting a charge under a Reconstruction era statute that was designed to go after the KKK, which is one of the two charges that Lemon and Georgia Fort are facing? The other charge that we just heard the Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General talk about, the FACE Act, which prevents interfering or threatening, obstructing access to both churches, but also reproductive rights facilities, abortion clinics. So I really want to see the evidence. And when the indictment was finally unsealed Friday, I thought it was a stretch. I thought it was mm-hmm. a big stretch. So that's the legal question. The other thing I want to see is what the administration is doing in messaging here. And instantly, we see the White House gloating. And I think that's the right verb. They said, when life makes you lemons, and then they had emoji of chains. Mm-hmm. The message from the White House is, you better watch what you say. You better watch what you report. We'll make an example of you. We will throw the book at you. And that's designed to chill speech, designed to chill press freedom.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the impact in just a moment. And so, Brian, wanted to get your reaction, your thought, just the first kind of questions that came to your mind when you heard that journalists were arrested for covering a protest.
Number one, is there anything that Don Lemon or Georgia Fort did that other journalists would not have done? And when it involves private property, when it involves a church, yes, there are some ethical questions to ask. There might in some cases even be legal questions to ask. But Lemon and Fort were doing a public service by live streaming from the church that day. For viewers who have not actually watched these videos, I recommend watching them in full, because you see Don Lemon interview some of the protesters, yes. You also see him interview some of the worshipers. And I personally, as a viewer, I learned a lot about what happened thanks to those interviews. So Lemon has been very clear that he was there as a journalist, not as an activist. And when you look at his journalism, the actual journalism he produced, I think it had a lot of value.
On YouTube, Mr. Harold Williams Jr., 4087, says no judge would sign off on the charges. That's why they had to get a grand jury. Wesley says Don Lemon was part of the protest even before they gathered. He even fed them and turned the camera away when they were giving the protest details. That's not journalism. That's activism. All right, Will, let's get into this, because this is part of this specific case, is coordination beforehand and whether that matters in terms of your legal liability. So give us sort of the legal rundown.
Let me first of all echo what Brian says. You don't have a right as a journalist or as a protester to enter private property without an invitation. When the pastor asks Don Lemon and Georgia Fort and the protesters to leave, and they don't leave, now you're trespassing. Now you're engaging in civil disobedience. You don't have a special First Amendment right as a journalist to trespass. So that's number one. Number two, this is what I mean about, I think, the charges being really thin. And just as the commenter says, the government had to go to a magistrate judge who refused to sign off on the charges against Fort and Lemon, then appealed to a federal district court judge, likewise denied the warrant, then appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, which refused to grant the warrant. So then they got the indictment. And that should tell you something about the sufficiency of the evidence here. I think it's pretty thin. I think it's thin gruel. You have to make the case that Lemon conspired with these protesters to go and interfere, threaten, obstruct the exercise of First Amendment freedoms in that private place, and you just don't see it. You see Lemon asking questions of folks on the way out. They're going to make the case that he's physically obstructing them. As Brian says, the tape shows something
I know it's
different.
A super rare charge, but is there a sense, is there an established case law around what you would have to do beforehand to be a co-conspirator?
Right, you'd have to have the intent to say, we're going to go in there and we are going to disrupt this thing and you're going to work with us and we are going to threaten and oppress folks who are otherwise peacefully engaged in private worship. And they're going to have to prove that. That's a very heavy burden. And to our knowledge, me and my colleagues, there's never been a case brought against a journalist specifically on these charges. So this is
unprecedented.
Right.
Yeah. And I think about the fact that these journalists, Brian, they are independent journalists. They're also happen to be journalists of color. And there's so many other things. They don't have like the institutional cover of a large news organization like a CNN, like a NBC. And so your thoughts on what that says, and I say this in particular because I've had people comment on my Facebook post talking about the fact that, they feel like there has been this sort of censoring in large organizations and that independent journalists have had this freedom. And now this is sort of a fear tactic. Your thoughts on impact of that on independent journalists in particular.
The diversity of the media system is a good thing. It is a good thing to have journalists who are out there on their own, streaming to YouTube and Instagram. And then it's also a good thing to have the Associated Press and NBC and the Washington Post and Reuters out there doing that work in big institutions. I say the more the merrier. We're benefiting when we have all of the above. But I do have to wonder if it's a coincidence that the government has targeted Lemon and Fort here, both of whom are independent journalists without those newsrooms. I used to work with Lemon at CNN. You know, I have on speed dial the numbers of a bunch of CNN lawyers. Hopefully I won't ever need those numbers. But Lemon used to have those same numbers as well. And it does make a difference when you are on your own without that backup. However, Lemon was also very smart to quickly hire an attorney as soon as the Justice Department started to threaten him. You know, he hired one of the best attorneys in D.C. to deal with this kind of case. So he is prepared. He is ready for this. And as he said earlier today, like, he's not going to let them take away his joy. He is still doing what he does, doing what he loves every day. But it is, you know, it does seem to many observers of these cases that the real goal is not to win, because, yes, the right. burden's going to be so high for the prosecution. That the real goal is to have a chill, to cause a chilling effect, to make journalists think twice. And if that is the goal, let me just say, it's not working.
I was going to ask you that, Brian.
Not like, be deterred.
This feels like a true Streisand effect moment. I've not heard Don Lemon's name this much in many years.
No.
maybe not since those.
And
know,
he's on. Look, he's on Jimmy Kimmel Live tonight. Yeah. You know, he's choosing to appear with
he's
someone
at the
who's
Grammys.
Been
yeah,
in the Trump administration. Yeah, yeah. That's not a coincidence. Yeah. You know, I look at this and I think that Lemon. You know, let me try to steel man the argument though. Where's the Trump administration coming from? For them, it's all about religious freedom, right? That's what they claim. This is about the rights of churchgoers being infringed by the journalists and the activists. And, you know, I can understand why they're making that argument. It resonates very strongly in MAGA media. Fox News was all over this story as soon as it happened, thanks to Lemon's viral videos. So from the Trump administration's point of view, they are waging a war on behalf of religious freedom. However, to journalists looking at this, and I think just a lot of ordinary Americans who've watched the videos, they see that what the indictment claims is not actually what happened inside the church.
Yeah.
So I think that brings me to a broader question for you, Brian, which is when you look at the various tactics the Trump administration has used to maybe suppress coverage that's unfavorable or boost coverage that is favorable. And I should say, by the way, all administrations do this on some level. When you look at the various tactics the Trump administration has used, which do you think are actually the most effective in achieving those ends? Because there's a lot of different examples we can point to. We can talk about what they've done with mergers and how perhaps they use that as a cudgel for reshaping CBS News. Is that more effective than this? There are other ways that they've tried to shape the narrative. When you look across sort of the menu of options they're choosing from, which do you look at and say, this is actually going to change the way media report on the government?
Right. It's hard to talk about the chill in the air because we don't know what stories are going untold.
Right.
And we don't know if there are examples of stories that are going untold. You know, that's always the great unknown. That's always the great mystery. But when I look around the landscape, I see media companies that, yes, have been accused of capitulation. Paramount, for example, the parent company of CBS, by settling with Trump to make a frivolous lawsuit against 60 Minutes go away, Paramount definitely capitulated. And yet, CBS News continues to cover the Trump administration aggressively. There have been some issues with the new editor-in-chief, Barry Weiss, a lot of controversies involving Weiss, and yet the news is still getting reported. So all of these attempts by the administration have been only modestly or somewhat effective at trying to control access to information. When I say what are the most effective, I probably would point to the lawsuits, though.
Yeah.
The lawsuits against the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the BBC, etc., because these cost media companies money that they don't want to have to spend on defense. Mm-hmm. But here's what we've learned. When media companies fight back via the legal system, they usually win. CNN was sued by Trump a few years ago. There was an initial success with an initial judge, and then an appeals court reaffirmed that Trump's case was not going to go forward. So there are these success stories when media companies are willing to push.
I want to ask you a quick follow-up, because you're like inside a large media company, right? I'm just curious, like, has it ever come across your desk, or has an editor ever mentioned to you or one of your colleagues, like, hey, maybe let's lay off this story. We think it could trigger a lawsuit by the Trump administration.
No, never. The only thing that I think about in those regards is what are all different kinds of viewers thinking about this story? So when it comes to the church protest, I'm interested in how conservative Christians feel seeing that video. And I want to reflect that point of view in my coverage, as well as the point of view of the anti-ICE protesters. But that's not out of fear of lawsuits. That's out of a desire to be recognizing what's going on in America and doing what you do on this program every day, trying to hear all the different points of view out there.
Yeah, I want to read a comment. Scott says the press has already been suppressed. First, it was self-censoring just for ratings and funding. Once that stone was overturned, it was easy to use authoritarian tactics, censorship, legal harassment, all supported by the government and government-sponsored lobbyists. He says, we literally saw how every independent-friendly news organization was barred from the White House press corps Tucker Carlson was even mentioned during his backlash for interviews on Israel. And so, Will, I want to bring you back into the conversation and sort of talk up. There has been this push-pull and these battles between organizations and the Trump administration. And I think about the Associated Press being sort of kicked out of the White House press pool because they refused to refer to the Gulf of America and things like that. Can you sort of, like, you know, how Brian sort of said that when the press organizations fight back, they win. Is that the case? And have there been, has that sort of, do you view that as sort of deterring the Trump administration? Because it doesn't seem like it does, when they win.
Yeah, that's a good question, Chair. I'll take that in two parts. First of all, when institutions fight back across civil society, we have seen success. I think the last time I had the honor of being on with you folks, we were talking about the administration's threats to academic freedom and free speech at universities. And when a university like Harvard University decides to use some of its endowment to fight back, so far so good. They've been winning. But too often, institutions capitulate. And I think that's a strategy to separate and attack. And so I do think there has been some reticence to stick one's neck out if you're a private institution. So whether the Trump administration has been deterred, I don't think so. I think part of the appeal for them politically is to be able to say, look at us. We are taking action. We are going to throw the book. We are going to send out the emoji-laden tweet and kind of chum the waters for our base. It's performative. It's useful for political purposes, even if it's not legally successful. I think that's part of the decision-making process.
Yeah, and so, Brian, I wonder, like, because you said that you don't get emails or, you know, you never received an email that says, don't do this story. But I just wonder sort of how chilling effects sort of take place, like how it sort of ripples through a newsroom. If it's not direct, are there other ways that maybe folks that you've talked to or you hear about that chilling effect sort of ripples through newsrooms and maybe even through independent journalists? Because it is very inconvenient to have to hire an attorney and to go to court and to be arrested and to have all those things happen.
Absolutely. You know, let me say, you know, first, my experience at CNN is when I feel that I'm, you know, using especially strong language, when I'm really being clear-eyed about what's going on, I find I get more support, not less. Meaning, if I'm on a limb, I'm getting more support. And by the way, those are the stories people want to read more. Those are the stories people want to watch more. So let me just say all that about my own experience, truly. But you're asking, how can it happen? Here's how I think it happens in some places. Maybe among journalists with fewer years of experience, maybe they don't feel as secure in their positions. Maybe they feel more vulnerable to layoffs. Maybe they're not under contract. Maybe they're freelancing. Maybe they're working for a smaller news outlet. Maybe they self-censor a little bit. Maybe they think twice before using a strong, pointed word to describe Trump's lies. Maybe they hesitate before devoting 2 minutes to a story that really deserves that time. You know, that's how it can happen. And I think probably has happened around the edges, especially at media companies that are under regulatory review and pressure. Meaning if your network or your station has business before the government, you're going to feel that pressure trickle down from on high. And I think we have heard of some examples of that at TV and radio stations across the country, thankfully not in Philly. So I think there is some of that that's happened, but it's hard to prove, right? Because you're talking about the psychology of the journalist in deciding what headline or what word to use in a story. I think there has been some of that. But then the flip side is you have more Don Lemons and Georgia Forts out there. You do have more people who are blogging on Substack and live streaming on YouTube who in some cases are more opinionated. They might be more provocative. But I think in some ways they have filled in some of the voids that are out there right now.
Yeah.
Let me bring in a caller. This is Peter from Queen Village on the line. Hey, Peter, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So the first thing that comes to my mind is back in October of 2024, Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Washington Post, killed an endorsement for Kamala Harris at the last minute. And recently I've read that the Washington Post is facing people being laid off. And so I think when people say the blowback from the public, it can do something. But when you have somebody who owns a media company and is calling the shots,
even in an editorial, which in my experience, that is, you know, hands off. You know, what do you do? And he holds the purse string, so he does call the shots. And so that was the first thing that came to my mind when I was listening to this radio station, was that it upset a lot of people when he did that. But I don't know if anything was ever, you know, repercussions were ever really felt.
Thanks, Peter. That's Peter from Queen Village. Look, I think, I guess I'll be the skeptical journalist here and say, you know, I think some of the examples we're pointing to right now are all things that have happened through history. Newspaper barons have definitely controlled the messages of op-ed pages. Jeff Bezos is really just the latest. And there's always been pressure from the federal government to cover things the way the government wants it to be covered. And I do think we have to ask the skeptical question, Will, of something, whether something is truly extraordinary is happening right now and whether it's being effective. Because at the end of the day, there's a million journalists in Minneapolis right now.
That's right.
There's people streaming every single move. There's people criticizing the government all the time. And I think you have to really ask those twin questions. Is this unprecedented? And then B, is the unprecedented action, if it's happening, having an effect on what the media is doing day to day?
I love this question, Avi. I think as to the first point, my friends over at the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, I trust them on these questions all the way. And when they say this is unprecedented, we haven't seen these kinds of charges brought,
right,
I'll defer to them. But your second point is very well taken. This is part of a long history. I mean, William Randolph Hearst, right? Yeah. I mean, we can go all the way back. As long as there's been printers, there's been the government trying to say,
I mean, newspapers used to be explicitly aligned with political parties. So that is some, in some ways, this idea of a neutral press is a little bit of a modern idea, but go ahead.
That's right. I will recommend everybody to take time out of your day to go to Twitter and check out the investigative journalist Ronan Farrow, writes for The New Yorker quite often. He had an excellent thread last night. And if you're not a regular Twitter user, just, you know, put on your hazmat suit and dive in there. Check it out. It's excellent. What Ronan does is track the expansion, starting with, I think his example, start with the Obama administration, going through Biden, the expansion of federal government pushback and willingness to target disfavored voices. This isn't just a Trump thing, although I would argue that Trump's approach has been of an increased intensity and scope. So I do think we're in uncharted waters. But Ronan's point is that when every administration tries to push, it gives space to the next one to push the boundaries a little further. And that's what you have to watch out for.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, and Brian, I wonder, as because our caller talked about the Washington Post situation. And I remember the Washington Post lost so many subscribers. And a lot of people have taken issue with CBS and their recent coverage and some of the personnel changes they made there. And a lot of people stopped watching the evening news. I just wonder sort of how you, as someone who analyzes the media and studies this, how you think audiences perceive these sort of, you know, the pushing and the limitations put on the press by government. How do you see the audience perceiving this?
Right. Number one, we all live in our own personalized media bubble. And there are some folks who really like their pro-Trump media bubble, and they don't want to hear the bad news that the rest of us have been covering day by day. Trump may be trying to, you know, blow up the Kennedy Center, being the example that I'm dealing with today. But there's always a new one every day. And that pro-Trump audience is not hearing it. But for others who are in other personalized media bubbles, it is clear that when a news outlet appears to be bending the knee or capitulating, that news outlet is punished by the audience. The Washington Post is the best example. As you just said, big subscriber losses as a result of the Bezos changes at the Post. And right now you have journalists there facing layoffs, but still fighting really hard to report and break stories. In fact, the best story about the Kennedy Center last week was an exclusive by the Washington Post.
Right.
And so, you know, we see journalists on an individual basis still doing the work, even though institutionally there are these pressures. And then the good news, the silver lining for all of us, is that if the Washington Post keeps shrinking, if the journalists there keep getting laid off, if the place keeps getting less relevant, you're going to see something new emerge. You're going to see a new version. Someone's going to launch something as a startup to compete with it. I guarantee it. You know, that energy will go somewhere. And again, that's how the cases of Lemon and Fort are unique, right? Independent journalists, they were the ones inside the church to show everybody else what happened.
Mm. That's Brian Stelter, chief media analyst for CNN Worldwide and lead author of the Reliable Sources newsletter. Brian, appreciate your time today on Studio 2. Equal thanks to Will Creeley, legal director of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Always a pleasure to have you, Will.
Thank you.
And coming up, we are going to talk to a reporter, James Risen, who was once the target of government intervention. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Today we've been talking about the freedom of the press, asking the question, is it under assault?
And continuing with us in studio, we have Will Creeley, legal director of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. And now we want to welcome into the conversation James Risen, someone who is very familiar with threats to First Amendment rights. Risen was a national security reporter for the New York Times and for 7 years fought a legal battle with the federal government who wanted him to reveal his sources. Risen now teaches investigative journalism at the University of Maryland. Jim, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And we still want to hear from you out there this hour. Our question for you, are you concerned about the freedom of the press? Jack says simply, nope, too many other problems. Okay, that's fair.
All right.
Call 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Before we went to break, Jim, Will mentioned this idea that some of the actions of prior administrations had created little bits of wiggle room along the way for the Trump administration to launch various attacks on journalists or outlets that it doesn't like. I'm curious what your insights are into that as someone who's maybe been part of that wiggle room carving over the years. Do you think that past Trump administration, the Obama administration, Biden administration, in some ways laid the groundwork for what we're seeing today?
Yeah, it wasn't just wiggle room. They created an interstate highway for the destruction of the freedom of the press, starting really in the modern era. It really starts with the Bush administration after 9/11, and then the Obama administration continued, and then the first Trump administration. The Obama administration really took the title of having the most prosecutions of whistleblowers of any administration, and then basically the Trump administration I think more or less tied that record. And in all of those prosecutions of whistleblowers, it was about people who had gone to the press to talk to reporters. And in my case, the Bush administration and then the Obama administration both went to tried to force me to reveal my sources and threaten me with jail if I didn't reveal my sources. And the Obama administration actually won a very important legal precedent in my case that is helping the Trump administration today. The judge in my case kept rejecting their efforts to force me to testify. She kept quashing their three different subpoenas of me, but eventually the Obama administration appealed her rulings and took it to the Fourth Circuit mm-hmm. Court of Appeals, where they made a ruling that still is the law that is the most dangerous press freedom law in America. It was a law that said, a ruling in my case that said, journalists have no special rights or privileges in a criminal case. They have to testify or go to jail. And all of their notes and all of their materials are subject to seizure. And that was such a horrible decision that I tried to get the Supreme Court to overturn it, and the Supreme Court refused to hear the mm-hmm. case.
Yeah,
that is now the law of the land. The Fourth Circuit is really important because it covers Virginia and Maryland, which is home to the CIA, the Pentagon, the NSA, and every part of the classified world where most leaks occur.
Yeah.
And so Trump is taking advantage of something that happened under Obama.
And so, Jim, I just want to sort of level set people, tell people briefly just about your situation, because you had a source come to you. You had a breaking story. You held that information for a time, and then the Bush administration came after you. Could you just explain briefly about that and what it's been like for you over the years having to fight multiple administrations to protect your source?
Yeah, there were actually two major stories that the government came after me on. One was about, we revealed the NSA's domestic spying program about 10 years before Edward Snowden, frankly. The government started a leak investigation of our story. And then I published a book soon after that, where I revealed a screwed up CIA operation about the Iran nuclear program, where the CIA tried to give nuclear blueprints to the Iranians. And then they came after me on that too. They had two different grand juries coming after me at the same time. And eventually they dropped the NSA leak investigation and only tried to prosecute me and sources on the CIA story. Eventually that they subpoenaed it in 2008, and then the case finally ended in 2015 when the Obama administration had already won the legal case, but they were getting such bad publicity, they decided not to try to put me in jail.
Sean comments and says, although I love your show, Studio 2, my faith in the freedom of press in general is at all-time low. Only certain outlets are permitted at press briefings, and many outlets are owned by billionaires.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to zero in on something that Jim mentioned, Will, which is this idea, you know, codified in the law on some level, that the press really doesn't have any sort of special rights that anyone else doesn't enjoy. Now, people are going to hear that and say, wait a second, don't they mention the press in the First Amendment? They do.
They do, explicitly.
They do. But what does that really mean in terms of the law? Just putting the word press in there doesn't necessarily mean a journalist has different privileges than anyone else. So what can you tell us about that, Will?
Yeah, the press is a vital component. As you say, it's one of the five freedoms outlined in the First Amendment, freedom of the press. It does not give you immunity from prosecution if you engage in lawbreaking, but there has been a traditional recognition of the First Amendment freedoms, and there has been a corresponding hesitation
reluctance
on prosecutors to push too hard on these points. And Jim's story tells you about what happens when that reluctance goes away.
But it's a self-restraint is what you're telling me. It's not necessarily a restraint baked into the law. It's the idea that people read the First Amendment, people in positions of power in the government, and they said, you know what? Our framers, our founders thought that this was a sacred thing. Let us restrain ourselves from going after them.
It's a little bit more than just a norm. There are protections. For example, if you receive information as a journalist and that information was obtained unlawfully, but you did not have a hand in that unlawful activity, you can publish that. You're protected. Bartnicki v. Vopper. Likewise, in a case, Brandsburg v. Hayes, the court says it's not that news gathering does not have any protection. It does. It's just still vague as to what the contours of that protection are. And I would argue that a correct reading of the First Amendment really does provide some explicit protection for journalists engaged in journalistic activity. I think it's crucial. What's scary about the government's theory, thinking back to the Lemon and Fort case, is that it seems to blur the line between covering an unlawful activity and participating in it. You don't want a situation where journalists are afraid to report on lawlessness. Mm-hmm. Or that reporting on it somehow subsumes their journalistic activity into the lawless activity itself.
Right.
That's really dangerous. And that's, I think, the line we're approaching here.
And so, one of the things that I've realized, you know, when you're a journalist is that we don't necessarily have a codified shield law that protects us nationally. What we do have is, just a network of state laws and case law. So I wonder, like, your thoughts on that, that there's nothing that explicit that journalists can necessarily point to for protection. It's more like this goodwill. And a lot of times the public don't necessarily stand up for journalists.
That's right. What we've learned, if the Trump administration has taught us anything, is that if something is not locked down by statute, if it's not nailed down, it'll get picked up and thrown. And I think that now is the time to start reevaluating legislative efforts to, for example, amend the Espionage Act. I think it was Mr. Farrow's Twitter thread I mentioned earlier. He said something like there are 117 prosecutions under Obama under the Espionage Act. Those are going after whistleblowers. Those are going after leakers. There should be some kind of protection because the folks who have that information, just as Jim's case demonstrates, are the folks who can tell us something really important about what's going on with our country. I think back to the landmark Pentagon Papers case, which is how we found out as a country that a lot of what the official line on the Vietnam War had been was completely false. We need to have that kind of access to information to be an informed citizenry and make the right choices on election day.
And Jim, I just wanted to get your thoughts really quickly because I wondered what the public reaction. You're a journalist. You put your livelihood, you put your freedom on the line to protect your sources and to make sure that the public was aware of vital information. What was the public reaction to your case? What was the support like? And what did you see the issues around the public being, I guess, aware and knowledgeable of what was happening?
I think one of the problems I had was at the beginning, it didn't get very much attention. And it took a long time for me to get much public support because the press didn't really, the press has this kind of perverse dislike of covering itself. And so my case didn't get much attention until it went up to the Supreme Court. Finally, then it became clear that it was a constitutional issue and it got more attention. And that's when the Justice Department pulled back because they were afraid of all of the negative attention they were getting, even though they had won in court. And I think that's what we need today is much more public support for the press than we've ever had before, because the danger now is greater than it ever has been. And I think to your point earlier, which is the real issue has been that it hasn't been statutorily codified. These things, all of the protections for the way we operate as journalists have come from court rulings over the last 40 or 50 years or from guidelines imposed by attorneys general, which are then easily overturned by the next administration. And so we need some actual federal statutes to provide greater protection to journalists.
Matt comments and says, I grew up in a time when neutrality of the press was a given. Many journalists didn't even vote because they were concerned about appearing biased. We had regulations that require broadcasters give both points of view equal time on public airways. Today, I see instances of press bias on both left and right. So unfortunately, I feel like the press has given away its own freedom to its own biases. It didn't seem to need outside sources to restrict it. That's Matt's.
I think anybody who thinks that, I think this is one of the great problems in America today, which is too many Americans take freedom of the press for granted. They don't realize how central to democracy that it is. If you want to see what the difference is, go live in Russia for a while, or go live in China for a while, and see what a country without a free press looks like.
I want to ask before we close about the incident at the home of the Washington Post reporter Hannah Natenson. So if you don't know, Natenson works for the Post, covers the Trump administration, specifically more recently its attempts to remake the federal bureaucracy. The FBI executed a search warrant at her home on Wednesday, January 14th. They seized her phone, two laptops. The warrant does not say that she's accused of any wrongdoing here. They say the warrant says it's related to an investigation into a contractor that she had some contact with. However, the social media statements by members of the Trump administration sort of allude to her being complicit in it somehow. And this is where we get into this very confusing middle space. I'm just curious, Jim, as we close, what you made of that raid on Natenson's home and where you think it fits in the broader arc of the problem you're describing here.
Well, it goes back to the fact that there are no serious legal protections for the way that we operate. And it goes back to the fact that the Biden administration imposed new guidelines that would have stopped something like this. And then as soon as the Trump administration came in, they got rid of the Biden guidelines. on how to deal with reporters. That's why it's important to have something more than guidelines that protect the way we operate. Or, you know, I mentioned Brandsburg earlier, which is this old legal case from the 1970s. There are really no deep court rulings or deep statutes that protect us in the way that we need protection. Federal shield law keeps bubbling up every few years and then never makes it through Congress. And I think that's what we need now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'll go back to what Matt's comment was, though, as we close here, Will, which is that Matt, I think, was essentially saying, if you're trying to get a law like this passed, you're trying to get extra protections for the press has done itself no favors because it has not covered itself in glory over however X many number of years. Now, I don't know what Matt's referring to when he talks about the press, who gets included in all that. But why do you think it's difficult in this country to codify specific protections for the press?
First of all, Congress doesn't do much of anything anymore.
Sure.
So that's first of all. And Professor Eisen's exactly right. There is this effort every few years to galvanize support around reforming, for example, the Espionage Act, getting a federal shield law. It doesn't go anywhere. I think that politicians have a natural distrust of the press and find themselves in adversarial positions, whether they're on the left or the right. It's just not a constituency that has a lot of popular political support. So again, just as the good professor says, it's going to have to be a demand of the people.
Mm. Wow. Well, the press needs to hire some lobbyists.
I hope the people judging the show today look favorably upon it, and you'll make your own determinations. I want to thank you, Jim Risen, national security reporter for The Intercept, for your time today.
Thanks.
Same to you, Will Creeley, legal director of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, also known as FIRE. Will, always appreciate your time on Studio 2.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and thank you to our caller from today and the folks who wrote in and commented on Facebook. You really add so much to the discussion. And of course, we couldn't do any of this without our producers, Debbie Bilder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Marie Bryan. Thank you so much. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're going to keep on talking.
Yep.
And we'll talk to you tomorrow.